This is Lecture 7 of the series Inflation and Price Controls.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Tonight, we will continue with our discussion of how price controls and shortages cause chaos in production and distribution. Specifically, I will show how they cause chaos in the personal distribution of goods to individual consumers, in the geographical distribution of goods among various local markets, and in the distribution of factors of production among their various uses or employments. Then I will show how shortages of price-controlled goods tend to raise the demand for other goods, and what the major consequences of this phenomenon are. As part of this discussion, I will deal at length with two matters of immediate relevance, namely the existing rent controls on part of the supply of housing and the existing price controls on part of the supply of oil. Finally, I will show why price controls tend to spread until all prices and wages are controlled and universal shortages are created. Let us begin. Back in Lecture 5, we saw that in a free market, consumers' goods in limited supply are distributed to the individual consumers in accordance with a combination of two criteria, namely, their relative wealth and income on the one side, and the relative strength of their needs and desires for the goods on the other. For example, we saw that these two criteria determine the distribution of such goods as rare wines and rental housing space. We saw also that the same principle of distribution applies to factors of production in limited supply, or at least to the benefit derived from such factors of production. For example, we saw that products of wheat or skilled labor or whichever, considered as a group, are distributed to the buyers on the basis of their relative wealth and income and needs and preferences for such products. Now, price controls and shortages totally disrupt this principle of distribution. What they substitute is not another principle, but merely the rule of the random, of the arbitrary and the accidental, the rule of chaos. Think back to the gasoline shortage and observe what determined the distribution of gasoline. It was a matter of luck and favoritism. Gasoline went to those who happened to be on the spot when deliveries were made to gas stations, or who had the time to waste waiting hours in line or following gasoline delivery trucks around. And of course, it went to those who happened to be friendly with service station owners or the employees of service stations. Both the wealth and the needs of the buyers in relation to their wealth were made irrelevant. The country's most productive businessmen were placed on an equal footing with welfare recipients. The value of their higher incomes was simply nullified. It was just a question of who arrived first or who had the right friends. By the same token, people whose very livelihood depended on gasoline were in no better position to obtain it than people wanting it for the most marginal purposes. Again, it was just a question of who got there first and who had the right friends. Rent-controlled apartments are distributed in just the same way. If meat were placed under price control, it would not be long before it too was distributed in this way. The distribution of any good subjected to price controls becomes chaotic just as soon as the controls produce a shortage. Let us turn now to the chaos introduced into the geographical distribution of a good among various local markets. we already know from Lecture 4 that price controls prevent an area that has an urgent need for a product from obtaining it by bidding up its price in competition with other areas. And there is no need to repeat our previous discussion of the implications of this fact for such events as the Arab oil embargo, when price controls prevented the Northeast and the United States as a whole from bidding up the price of oil and thereby securing replacement imports for the lost Arab imports. However, in order to fully appreciate the chaos caused by price controls, I want to call your attention to a further major element of chaos introduced specifically by the existence of shortages. Under the combination of price controls and shortages, not only is the price of a good prevented from rising, but also, paradoxically, it is prevented from falling. The combination of price controls and shortages prevent prices from falling as well as from rising. Please observe, where a shortage exists, an increase in the supply of a good or decrease in the demand for it does not reduce the price. It merely reduces the severity of the shortage. Where a shortage exists, an additional supply merely makes it possible for someone to buy at the same controlled price who previously could not do so. Likewise, a decrease in demand merely means a reduction in the number of those contending for the supply who must go away empty-handed. The price does not fall in such circumstances because it is already too low as a result of price controls. The significance of the fact that prices can neither rise nor fall is that a broad range of indeterminacy is introduced into the geographical distribution of a good. Because of shortages, producers are in a position to sell a larger quantity in every market without any reduction in the price in that market, or therefore in the profitability of supplying it. All that they have to do is find an additional supply of the good to sell and deliver it. What this situation makes possible, in essence, is that producers can send their goods practically anywhere in widely varying proportions, and it doesn't matter to them. If they send too little to some areas, the price controls in those areas prevent prices and profits from rising and halting the drain. Meanwhile, in the areas into which they are sending too much, shortages prevent prices and profits from falling and stemming the inflow. In a word, the geographical distribution of a good simply becomes random and chaotic, disconnected from the consumer's needs and purchasing power. Consider the following case, based on the experience of the gasoline shortage. The price control on gasoline created a shortage in the whole northeastern region of the United States. Almost every state and locality in that region had its own individual shortage. In this context, it largely ceased to matter to the oil companies how their gasoline was distributed among the various areas in the region. Suppose, for example, that they sent 1 million gallons less a day to New Jersey and 1 million gallons more a day to Connecticut. It didn't matter to them. The price of gasoline in New Jersey and the profit in sending it there could not rise, even if New Jersey received hardly any gasoline at all. Price controls prevented it. At the same time, the price of gasoline in Connecticut and the profit in sending it there could not fall until the shortage in Connecticut was totally eliminated. Of course, just the reverse could have occurred. 1 million gallons less a day could have been sent to Connecticut, and 1 million gallons more a day could have been sent to New Jersey. Price control would have prevented any rise in the price and profit of sending gasoline to Connecticut, and so long as a shortage existed, it would have prevented any fall in the price and profit of sending gasoline to New Jersey. This indeterminacy introduced by price controls explains how some areas can suffer relatively mild shortages and other areas very severe shortages, and how their positions can easily be reversed. Please observe the significance of this. What it means is that price controls not only create shortages, but make it a random matter how the burden of those shortages is distributed. In the gasoline shortage, for example, it would have been possible for the various areas to share the burden of the overall shortage in any proportions. All might have suffered more or less equally, or some particular areas might have borne almost the entire shortage, while others suffered almost none at all, or any intermediate situation might have existed. The actual chaos that did exist fully accords with this principle. Precisely how the burdens are distributed is the result of accident. In the gasoline shortage, the main accidental factor was that the Northeast happened to be the region most heavily dependent on imports, and so it bore the far greater part of the nationwide burden. Within the Northeast, further accidental factors played a role, such as the very time of year when the controls were imposed. To understand this last point, imagine that the controls are imposed in summertime. In the summer, there is a large demand for gasoline in many resort areas. As a result, the wholesale price of gasoline in these areas is at a seasonal high in relation to the wholesale price in many city areas. It is high enough to cover such special summertime costs as may be entailed in having to bring in supplies from more distant refineries than is necessary in other seasons when the local demand in the resort areas is smaller. The imposition of controls freezes this seasonal price relationship and carries it forward to the fall and winter when there is a different pattern of demand, and when there should be a different set of gasoline price relationships to reflect it. Given the perpetuation of the summertime price relationships, what happens is that gasoline continues to be heavily supplied to the summer resort areas, perhaps to the point of pushing the price there somewhat below the level permitted by the controls. As a result, no shortage whatever exists in these resort areas. The entire shortage is concentrated in the cities. If the controls are imposed in the wintertime instead of the summertime, then of course the reverse situation develops. Now please observe in this connection the potency of small bureaucratic adjustments in the price controls. What I mean by this is that it is quite possible that after the controls are imposed, the officials in charge may make some minor adjustments here and there, such as for the purpose of rectifying the kind of seasonal problems I have described. In doing this, they unleash major movements in supply which they may not be aware of causing. Imagine, for example, that they decide to permit, say, a penny a gallon rise in the price of gasoline in one particular major city. If this small rise makes this particular city a relatively more profitable market than other markets, the various distributors will want to sell more heavily in this city. And as long as a shortage exists in the city, they can do so without any reduction in the newly increased price and profit. The effect will be that this particular city will tend to be supplied very heavily now, perhaps to the point of totally eliminating its local shortage, while supplies will simply disappear from other markets to the same extent. Frankly, it is impossible to know all the different factors that might suddenly unleash major movements in supply. The essential point is that under price controls and shortages, movements in supply have no effect on price and profit until a local shortage is totally eliminated. At that point, the local price and profit will be poised to fall, and the further movement of supplies to the area will stop. Short of that point, massive movements of supply are possible in response to very small differences in profitability. Anything that can create such differences can cause such movements. Now, this discussion of random geographical distribution that we have just had applies equally to the distribution of factors of production in limited supply among their various employments. Please recall the discussion back in Lecture 5 of how a factor of production in limited supply is allocated to its various employments in accordance with the bidding of the consumers for its various products. Recall, for example, our discussion of how the supply of wheat is distributed among baking bread, making crackers, feeding meat animals, and so on. We saw that more wheat would not be shifted from baking bread into making crackers because additional crackers could only be sold at lower prices, and therefore the cracker industry could only buy additional wheat at a lower price. We saw that a reverse shift in the use of wheat, namely from crackers to bread, could also not occur for just the same reason. We saw, in fact, that in a free market, the distribution of wheat and every other factor of production among its various employments is totally determinate. We saw that every factor is distributed to its most important employments. But now imagine that a shortage exists of all the different products that a factor of production is used to produce. In this kind of situation, there is a ready and waiting market for more of each product. More of each product could be sold without causing any reduction in its price or profitability until the shortage of that particular product was totally eliminated. All that it is necessary for producers to do is find a way of getting more of it to the market. In this situation, the allocation of the factor of production among its various uses becomes utterly chaotic. A factor of production can be withdrawn from the production of one of its products and added on to the production of another of its products. The price and profit of the product in reduced supply cannot rise to halt the decrease in supply. The price and profit of the product in expanded supply cannot fall to stop the increase in supply. Again, the oil shortage provides an excellent illustration of the principle. During the oil shortage, there was a shortage of all the different oil products, gasoline, heating oil, jet fuel, propane, kerosene, etc. In these circumstances, it essentially ceased to matter to the oil companies what they produced, which particular products. If they took 1 million barrels of crude oil away from the production of gasoline and added it on to the production of heating oil, they could sell the additional heating oil with absolutely no reduction in its price or profitability because of the shortage of heating oil. And if they did the reverse, if they took 1 million barrels of crude oil away from the production of heating oil and added it on to the production of gasoline, they could sell the additional gasoline with absolutely no reduction in its price or profitability because of the shortage of gasoline. And of course, the price and profitability of the product being cut back could not rise. It was controlled. The result was that the production of the various oil products was made random and chaotic. Practically any combination of products was possible. The only limits were those set by the possible total elimination of particular shortages. For example, gasoline production might have been expanded at the expense of heating oil production, up to the point where the gasoline shortage came to an end, and any further increase in the supply of gasoline would have forced a reduction in its price. At that point, the whole burden of the combined shortage of gasoline and heating oil would have been at the expense of heating oil. Or, of course, the reverse could have occurred. Heating oil production might have been expanded at the expense of gasoline production up to the point of eliminating the shortage of heating oil and throwing the whole burden of the combined shortage on gasoline production. Either of these extremes, or any intermediate situation, was possible. And not just with regard to gasoline and heating oil, of course, but with regard to the entire list of oil products. Any of them might have been produced to the point of no shortage, or any of them might have suffered a drastic reduction in production. And please note, the position of the various products could suddenly have been reversed, with the abundant ones suddenly becoming short, and the short ones suddenly becoming relatively abundant. And if we think back to the issue of geographical chaos and add that in, the situation could have been different in different parts of the country at the same time. For example, a severe shortage of gasoline and little or no shortage of heating oil in New Jersey, and just the opposite in Connecticut. The actual chaos that did exist during the oil shortage fully accords with this description. And once again, the same kind of random accidental factors determined what actually happened, as we saw when we considered geographical chaos alone. For example, the time of the year that the controls happened to be imposed played an important role in determining to what extent the overall oil shortage fell on heating oil or on gasoline production. Controls imposed in the summertime tend to cause relatively abundant supplies of gasoline and a severe shortage of heating oil in the following winter. That is because they impose the freeze at a time when the price of gasoline is high in relation to the price of heating oil. As a result, it will be profitable to go on producing gasoline and not profitable to step up the production of heating oil even after the summer ends. Conversely, controls imposed in the wintertime tend to cause a relatively abundant production of heating oil for the next winter, but a severe shortage of gasoline in the intervening summer. Similarly, it should be noted that bureaucratic adjustments in the controls can cause sudden major shifts in supply among the various products of a factor of production. By making the production of any one particular product of a factor of production somewhat more profitable than the others, for example, the officials administering the controls can bring about a sudden expansion in its production up to the point of totally eliminating its particular shortage, while, of course, correspondingly worsening the shortages of other products of the factor in an unpredictable way. And if they suddenly reduce the profitability of a particular item, they can make the supply of it disappear and other items show up in its place in an unpredictable way. Anything that produces even slight changes in the relative profitability of the various products of a factor, whether a bureaucratic change in the price control regulations or anything else, can produce major changes in supply when shortages exist. As just one example, Imagine that the uncontrolled price of some of the chemical additives used to make gasoline changed. If the prices of these chemicals rose, the relative profitability of gasoline might suddenly be impaired. Since the price of gasoline could not rise, while the price of other oil products would not fall, it would now pay to shift as much crude oil as possible away from gasoline production and to the production of all other oil products. Conversely, if the price of the chemical additives fell instead of rose, then gasoline production would suddenly become more profitable, and a massive increase in gasoline production would probably occur at the expense of the production of all other oil products. A principle that emerges from this discussion is that price controls and shortages create tremendous instability in supply. The supply of anything subjected to controls is subject to sudden, unpredictable shortages. Now, this chaos has a further important consequence, a phenomenon that I have already noted in other connections, but which deserves some special additional stress. And that is that shortages and the fear of shortages cause hoarding. If one cannot count on being able to buy something when one wants it, because it may be unavailable, then one had better try to buy it when one can. The effect of this is that price controls and shortages artificially expand the demand for everything even more. Price controls not only expand the quantity of goods demanded by virtue of artificially holding down prices, but also by virtue of creating shortages and then the need to hoard to cope with the shortages. The demand they create for hoarding is a demand that does not exist in a free market. It is not even a submarginal demand, because it would serve no purpose whatever in a free market. But under price controls and shortages, hoarding becomes a matter of survival and greatly adds to demand. The effect of this is that the irrationality of price controls goes beyond even what I have previously described. Back in Lecture 5, I explained how price controls prevented the most urgent and vital employments of a factor of production from outbidding its most marginal employments. I explained, for example, how they prevented truckers delivering food supplies from outbidding housewives wanting gasoline for marginal shopping trips. How they prevented the operators of oil rigs needing lubricants from outbidding homeowners seeking oil to heat their garages. Actually, the situation is even worse. Under price controls, the most vital and urgent employments of a factor of production are prevented from outbidding not only its most marginal employments, but from the standpoint of a free economy, its most submarginal employments. That is, its employment for hoarding purposes. Under price controls and shortages, it is entirely possible for people to be unable to get to work, to be without food, or even to freeze to death, not only because they cannot outbid the marginal employments of the oil or whatever factor of production they may require, but because products are being hoarded by other people in fear of this very kind of possibility happening to them. The consequence is that price controls and shortages not only sacrifice men's well-being and very lives to the unearned, fleeting gains of other men, but very largely to a hoarding demand created by price controls themselves. In effect, men are sacrificed to the controls themselves. Now let us turn to a further consequence of price controls and shortages. Namely, that the effect of a shortage of any particular commodity is to cause the unsatisfied demand for that commodity to spill over and add to the demand for other commodities. We have already had a glimpse of this principle last week in our discussion of people ending up having to buy more expensive models of goods as the result of the unavailability of less expensive models. For example, we saw the man who wants a 16-inch black and white television set may have to end up buying a 19-inch color set because there is a shortage of the 16-inch sets and he cannot obtain one. So he settles for this substitute. This principle of the spillover of demand applies not only to close mutual substitutes, such as different models of the same good, but also to goods which are totally dissimilar in their nature and function. For example, if our prospective buyer of a television set cannot find any model television set that satisfies him, he will eventually decide to buy some other kind of good. He may decide to buy a suit, or to apply the sum he wanted to spend for a television set to the purchase of a better car, or to any one of thousands of things or combinations of things. In this way, the money that price controls prevent from being spent in one channel is diverted to another channel. And this diversion of demand, please note, takes place almost immediately. For example, even if our prospective television set buyer decides to add the price of the set to his savings in the hope of being able to find the set later on, still the demand for other things will rise almost immediately. This is because he will almost certainly deposit his savings in a bank, which will lend them out. As a result, a borrower will be put in the position of being able to buy something with the money our man had wanted to use for a television set. Now, the effect of this diversion or spillover of demand depends on whether or not price controls apply to the second choice goods that people turn to. If these goods too are controlled, then the effect tends to be a worsening of the shortages of these goods. I will not elaborate on this consequence, however, until we begin our discussion of universal controls at the end of tonight's lecture. If price controls do not apply to the second choice goods, then the effect of the spillover of demand is simply to drive the prices of the uncontrolled goods still higher and to make the profitability of their production in comparison to that of the controlled goods still greater. This principle concerning the effects of the spillover of demand in a partially price-controlled economy has a number of important applications, which we will now consider. First, it shows that partial price controls, that is, price controls imposed merely on certain selected goods, are contrary to any rational purpose the government might have in imposing them. Observe, the government imposes controls on the goods which it believes are most vital. It imposes the controls because it believes they will enable people to obtain these goods who otherwise could not have obtained them because of too high a price. The government leaves uncontrolled those goods whose production it considers to be relatively unimportant. The effect of this policy, however, is to destroy the production of the very goods the government regards as vital, while encouraging the production of the goods it considers unimportant. This occurs because the price controls restrict or altogether destroy the profitability of producing the controlled goods. At the same time, the shortages the price controls create cause demand to spill over into the markets for the uncontrolled goods and thereby make their production still more profitable. For example, the government might control the price of milk on the grounds that it is a vital necessity, and leave uncontrolled the price of ice cream and soft drinks on the ground that they are trivial luxuries not worthy of its attention. The effect of this policy is to reduce the profitability of milk production in comparison with these and all other uncontrolled goods. As a result, it brings about a fall in the production of milk and thus creates a shortage of milk. The effect of the shortage of milk is to cause the unsatisfied demand for milk to spill over into the markets for uncontrolled goods, including, of course, ice cream and soft drinks, which then become correspondingly more profitable. The effect of the government's action, therefore, is to destroy the production of milk, which it regards as necessary and vital and wants people to have, and to promote the production of such goods as ice cream and soft drinks, which it considers unimportant. Clearly, it would be less illogical if the government imposed controls on the things it considered unimportant and whose production it did not mind seeing destroyed, and left free the production of the goods it considered vital. Nevertheless, governments do not do this, and again and again, in the early stages of a war, for example, they impose controls that undermine the production of necessities, while the so-called ashtray industries and the nightclubs and the cabarets flourish. Because temporarily, at least, these lines of business are left uncontrolled on the grounds of being unimportant and are therefore able to benefit from the spillover of demand caused by the shortages of necessities. A second application of the principle that shortages cause a spillover of demand and a rise in the prices of uncontrolled goods is that partial price controls cannot hold down the general price level. The expectation that they can is shared by everyone who believes that the problem of inflation consists in the rise of this or that group of prices and can be solved by prohibiting a particular group of prices from rising. Such controls hold down the prices of some goods only by making the prices of other goods rise all the more. Our formula for the general price level, which we learned back in Lecture 1, helps to explain this point. Please recall that the general price level equals aggregate demand divided by aggregate supply, or equivalently, the total spending for consumers' goods divided by the total quantity of consumers' goods sold. If aggregate demand and aggregate supply remain the same, the general price level must remain the same, even if some prices are controlled. For example, think back to the case of our hypothetical small economy of Lecture 1 that had $10,000 of demand and 1,000 units of supply, and therefore a general price level of $10 per unit. Imagine now that the government rolls back prices on part of the supply of that economy. It declares, say, that 500 units of the supply are to sell for no more than $5 per unit. As a result of this decree, people will be unable to spend more than $2,500 in buying this half of the supply. Note, they want to spend $5,000 and would spend $5,000 in buying this half of the supply, but the government's price control of $5 per unit makes it impossible for them to spend more than $2,500 in doing so. The result is that $2,500 of demand will spill over and drive up prices on the uncontrolled part of the supply. People will now spend $7,500 for the half of the supply that is uncontrolled, and its price, therefore, will rise to $15 per unit. Observe, aggregate demand remains $10,000 and aggregate supply 1,000 units. The general price level, therefore, remains $10 per unit. All that happens is that the government makes the 500 units of supply whose prices it controls sell at $5 per unit, and thereby causes the uncontrolled price on the remaining 500 units of supply to rise to $15 per unit. Now let us turn to a third application of the principle that shortages cause a spillover of demand and an increase in the prices of uncontrolled goods. Namely, that the supporters of price controls are mistaken in claiming that any particular price control, quote, saves people money, and in arguing that the repeal of any given control will, quote, cost people this or that amount of money. A control saves people money only in the sense of making them spend less for the controlled goods. At the same time, it makes them spend more for the uncontrolled goods. In the aggregate, they neither spend any less money nor receive any more goods than they would in the absence of the controls. Clearly, it is impossible that there could be any aggregate saving or gain by virtue of the controls. And that means, of course, that whatever saving or gain some buyers might obtain by virtue of the controls is necessarily at the expense of other buyers. Indeed, in view of the fact that controls tend to destroy the controlled industries, the only kind of long-run saving they can achieve for anyone, including the people who might temporarily gain from them, is a rather bizarre one. It consists in preventing a person from spending the money he wants to spend for the goods he wants to buy. In this sense, the drivers who could not obtain gasoline at the controlled prices, quote, saved money on gasoline. Instead of the gasoline they desperately wanted, and which they valued far above the controlled price, they had money left over to spend on other things which they wanted much less. Such savings are obviously absurd and contrary to purpose. They are comparable to making a person save money by not buying food or medicine or anything he values more, so that he may have money for something he values less, if he is alive to spend it. Yet this is the only kind of, quote, saving that controls can achieve in the long run, and it is the kind of saving they achieve right from the very beginning for whoever suffers from the shortages they create. The saving of money, in quotes, that controls bring about, therefore, is merely a forced shift of expenditure from things people want more to things they want less, and a temporary gain of some people at the expense of others and to their own long-run disadvantage. Furthermore, partial price controls not only do not save people money, but they actually cost them money, in that their effect is to raise the general price level. Partial controls have this effect because, in a variety of ways, they reduce the efficiency of production and therefore the aggregate amount of production and thus supply. As we saw in Lecture 6, they destroy vital industries on which the production of all other industries depends, such as the electric power industry and the oil industry. In the course of destroying an industry, they reduce the quality of its products and the service associated with them, thereby raising maintenance and replacement costs for the buyers of the products. We saw that controls also cause resort to unnecessarily expensive models and methods of production and lead to a system of cost-plus pricing. And as we saw earlier tonight, they create utter chaos in the geographical distribution of the products of a controlled industry and in the combination of the various products that such an industry produces. This disrupts all subsequent production that depends on these industries, and thus reduces aggregate supply. In all these ways, therefore, partial controls actually raise the general price level. Now, total controls, price controls on all goods, reduce production even more strongly than partial controls, as we will see next week. However, so long as they are in force, the price level is prevented from rising. Such controls may be said to, quote, save people money in an even more bizarre way than partial controls. As we will see, by virtue of creating a shortage of everything and thus making money simply unspendable, total controls enable people to save money in the sense of having it available for the purpose of eating it, or papering their walls or lighting their fires with it. And as production declines under total controls, and the volume of spending that can take place at the controlled prices accordingly drops further, the money that people save in this absurd way grows greater. It follows from our discussion that the repeal of price controls would not cost people anything. If total controls exist and are repealed, people would spend more money, but this greater spending would represent an exchange of otherwise useless paper for valuable goods, whose production would be greatly increased as a result of the repeal of the controls. This would obviously be a gain to everyone. If partial controls exist and are repealed, then the effect is a shift in the pattern of spending away from the previously uncontrolled goods to the newly uncontrolled goods. The prices of the former would tend to drop, while the prices of the latter would tend to rise. But since the effect of repeal is an increase in total production and supply, the general price level must tend to fall. The repeal of any partial control, therefore, must always tend to reduce the general price level by virtue of its effect in increasing production. It is only the repeal of a control, therefore, not the imposition of a control, that can truly be said to save people money. Now, I want to make two further special and rather detailed applications of the principle that shortages cause the unsatisfied demand for controlled goods to spill over into the market for uncontrolled goods and to raise their prices. The first of these applications is to rent controls, as they have existed in recent decades in places like New York City. The second will be to the present controls on oil prices. Both of these controls are partial price controls in an even more restricted sense than we have considered up to now. They are partial controls not only in the sense that they apply only to specific goods, but also in the further sense that they apply only to part of the supply, even of these goods. For example, in New York City, all housing completed since January 1974 is totally exempt from rent controls. Prior to August 1971, all housing completed since February 1947 had been free of controls, and certain still earlier housing, considered luxury housing, had also been exempted. All this previously uncontrolled housing, I should note, is now subjected to controls in the form of governmental limitations on annual rent increases. Perhaps even more important has been the fact that while rents have been controlled in New York City, they were generally uncontrolled in the surrounding suburban counties and in most of the rest of the country. Nor were the prices of houses controlled anywhere. As a result of the fact that rent control has had only partial application, large numbers of people in New York City were able to escape its effects. Those who could afford them were able to find uncontrolled apartments, or in many cases buy houses, co-ops, or condominiums in the city. Those who could not afford to live in New York City were able to find places to live outside the city. But before we consider the effects of this diversion of demand caused by partial rent controls, let us project the consequences of controls applied to all of these alternatives. In other words, let us project the consequences of a fully price-controlled housing market on a regional and national scale. We will see that some of the potentially most disastrous effects of rent controls have been avoided because of the availability of these close substitutes that have not been controlled. Observe, if the entire housing market were controlled, housing would be artificially cheap in all of its forms and everywhere. The quantity demanded of all types of housing would therefore exceed supply, and this would be true all across the country. As a result, there would be a shortage of living space and no way around it. People would simply be unable to find space in New York City, and they would be unable to find it in the surrounding counties or anywhere else in the country. There would be people desperate for living space with absolutely no way to obtain it. They would need apartments and houses with no better chance of finding them than they had of finding gasoline at the height of the gasoline shortage. What might happen in such circumstances? The answer is two things worth thinking about. Namely, the government would contemplate the assignment of borders to private homes and apartments. And it would contemplate the restriction of the internal freedom of migration throughout the country. On the first point, the argument would be made that people cannot be left to sleep in the streets, and that in the housing emergency, or whatever it might be called, it was necessary for those fortunate enough to have space to share it with those not fortunate enough to have space. As to the second point, it would soon become obvious that in the circumstances of a pervasive housing shortage, the influx of additional people into any area would have the effect of making the local housing shortage worse. Each area would therefore become anxious to keep out as many new arrivals as possible on the grounds of their worsening the local housing shortage. Each area would try to set up barriers to in-migration and try to prevail on the federal government to keep people where they were. This state of affairs actually exists in many countries. For example, it is no accident, but precisely for reasons such as these, that the Russian government deliberately restricts the number of inhabitants of its various cities and controls the internal movement of the Russian population. The communist sympathizers and apologists who boast about how inexpensive housing is in the communist countries, extremely limited and wretched housing, I might add, do not realize that precisely this is what creates a nationwide housing shortage in those countries. They do not realize that the low rents they are so proud of virtually necessitate restrictions on the internal movement of people, even apart from all other factors working in the same direction in the communist countries. And of course, families cannot take their privacy for granted in the communist countries. Millions of families are forced to live in communal apartments. Often, two families share a single room, separated from each other only by a curtain, just as depicted in the movie Ninotchka. As I have said, in areas of the United States where rent control has existed, such as New York City, people have been able to escape some of the most disastrous of its potential effects. This is because the controls have been confined to a limited part of the overall housing market. But even so, the consequences have been severe. Let us pass over quickly the consequences as they affect the part of the housing supply actually subjected to controls, and then focus on the consequences as they affect the part of the housing supply that has been left free of controls. We know that controls create a shortage of the housing to which they apply because people scramble for apartments at artificially low rents. We know that this fact, coupled with a lack of capital on the part of landlords that results from restricted profits, causes the quality of such housing to decline, in the process unleashing a spiral of mutually reinforcing hatred between tenants and landlords, as we saw last week. Ultimately, as the costs of operating buildings continue to rise because of inflation, the effect of rent control is to cause widespread abandonments of buildings by their owners. This occurs, as I explained last week, because continued operation not only represents the loss of the money originally invested in the buildings, but entails fresh out-of-pocket losses as well. Such abandonments have been going on for some years now in New York City at the rate of tens of thousands of apartments per year. As a result of rent control, there are growing areas in New York City, in the South Bronx, for example, that have been reduced to the status, literally, of a primitive village, with people living without electricity and having to fetch their water from public fire hydrants. Such facts are reported every so often in the New York Times. Now, as we should know from tonight's lecture, the shortage of housing that is under controls causes the unsatisfied demand for such housing to spill over and enlarge the demand for uncontrolled housing. Let us look at this phenomenon and its consequences more closely. The controls on rents bring space within the reach of people who otherwise could not have afforded it. That is their purpose, and that is what they achieve. But please observe that to whatever extent the controls make it possible for some people to obtain space who otherwise could not have obtained it, they simultaneously reduce the space that is available for other people who could have afforded to rent that space in a free market. This is a very crucial point, and so I will repeat it. To whatever extent rent controls enable some people to obtain space that they could not have obtained in a free market, they correspondingly deprive other people of that space who could have obtained it in a free market. These other people, of course, must then direct their demand for space into other channels, with the result that rents on uncontrolled space in the area rise. As far as the market is concerned, partial rent controls are equivalent to a reduction in the supply of rental housing. They take part of the housing stock off the market by giving it to people who could not afford the market rents. That leaves less of a supply of housing for the market and consequently increases rents on the diminished supply that is available for the market. Perhaps the very best and clearest way to understand these points is to think once again of the conditions of an auction. So imagine that I am an auctioneer and that these two sheets of paper that I am holding up each represent a unit of a good. Imagine further that the first three people up front on my far right, these three gentlemen over here, are bidders for these units. The first gentleman, the one to my furthest right, assume, is willing to bid a maximum of $300 for one of these units, if necessary. The gentleman in the middle is willing to go no higher than $200 for one of these units. The third gentleman can afford no more than $100. That is his maximum limit in the bidding. Now, in a free market, the price at which these two units will be sold will be above $100 and below $200. The price will have to be above $100 to eliminate the weakest bidder. It will have to be below $200 in order to find buyers for both units. It will tend to be the same for both buyers because there is usually no way to discriminate between them. Let's assume that the actual price turns out to be $150, right in the middle of the $100 and $200 maximum bids. Now observe, the weakest bidder has been excluded from this market. What must happen if we begin to feel sorry for him? Suppose a part of this audience begins to feel so sorry for him that they get a law passed that orders me, the auctioneer, to give him one of the units of my supply at a price he can afford, say $50. In this case, he gets his unit at $50. But now what must happen? Now, instead of my having 2 units to auction off, I only have 1 unit. The supply available for the market has fallen. And this 1 unit will now have to sell at a price that is somewhere above $200 and below $300. Say $250. It has to be high enough now to eliminate the middle bidder instead of the weakest bidder. All that has happened is that one party has gotten part of the supply at an artificially low price and has caused the price on the remaining supply to go high enough to eliminate another party. Please observe, the party eliminated could have afforded the market price if it were determined by the full available supply. But he cannot afford the market price as determined by the artificially reduced supply. This auction example does not differ in any essential respect from the case of partial rent controls. Partial rent controls give part of the supply of housing to some people at below market rents. To whatever extent these people could not have afforded as much space in a free market as they obtain under rent control, they leave that much less space available in the uncontrolled market. Consequently, rents in the uncontrolled market must rise that much higher in order to level down the quantity demanded with the reduced supply that is available for the market. For example, if the total housing supply in a city is 1 million rooms, and we give half of those rooms to people who could not have afforded them at free market rents, then we are correspondingly depriving other people of those rooms who could have afforded them at free market rents. And in the process, we make the rents on the uncontrolled 500,000 rooms rise so high that that diminished number of rooms is all that people will be willing and able to rent in the uncontrolled segment of the market. In other words, we make the open market rents balance demand and supply at a supply of 500,000 rooms instead of 1 million rooms. People are eliminated from the market who could have afforded market rents as determined by the full supply of rental housing. These people cannot afford market rents as determined by the artificially diminished supply of rental housing that results from rent control. Now, this fact that partial rent controls act to raise rents on the uncontrolled part of the housing supply is reinforced in another, different way. And that is that partial rent controls increase the costs of providing rental housing. This occurs because the existence of controls on some housing today implies that the housing that is presently free of controls may later on be brought under controls. The threat of being brought under rent controls in the future makes it necessary for landlords of presently uncontrolled buildings to recover their investments more rapidly. For example, instead of looking forward to recovering their investments over a 50-year period, say, the threat of rent control being imposed may make them want to recover their investments over a 10-year period, or even a 5-year period, to be safe. This represents a great jump in the costs of providing new rental housing, and it explains why high rents on uncontrolled buildings do not result in corresponding new construction. Insofar as rent control comes to be regarded as a regular institution, to be imposed at any future time the government may desire, the effect is to make today's tenants in uncontrolled buildings pay the spoils for tomorrow's future beneficiaries of rent control. This artificial increase in the costs of new housing, incidentally, is one of the reasons why today's so-called luxury housing is inferior in many respects to housing constructed in earlier decades. The reason is that it is not genuinely luxury housing, but rather cheap housing that must be rented at luxury rates in order to offset the prospective losses that are expected to be caused by rent controls in the future. The fact that partial rent controls increase the rents on uncontrolled housing is not recognized by the general public. And the result is that the higher partial controls drive rents, the more necessary people believe rent controls to be. The more desperately do they cling to existing controls, and the more eager they are to urge the extension of the controls. They fear that the repeal of the existing controls would raise all rents to the level of the presently uncontrolled rents. And they believe that the uncontrolled rents are enormous because they are not controlled. The truth is that the best solution to the problems created by rent controls would be their immediate and total abolition, accompanied by constitutional guarantees against their ever being reimposed. Now, I know that calling for the immediate abolition of rent control raises the question of what is to become of many of the people who are presently living in rent-controlled apartments and who would have to move if rent control were all at once repealed. In order to have some term to describe these people, let us refer to them as the beneficiaries of rent control, provided it is understood that they are beneficiaries in a short-run sense only and not genuine beneficiaries. Our previous discussion provides the answer of what would happen to these people if rent control were suddenly repealed. In essence, the answer is that they would simply have to change places with an equally large but generally unrecognized class of victims of rent control. Please keep in mind two facts about the immediate repeal of rent control. That is, not only the fact that it would raise rents to the beneficiaries of rent control, but also, as we have seen, that it would simultaneously reduce rents in the open market, because the space presently occupied by the beneficiaries of rent control would be added to the supply in the open market. What would happen in response to these changes in rents is two related sets of developments, the one affecting the beneficiaries of rent control, the other the victims. Let us consider the effects on the beneficiaries first. In the face of a jump in their rents, some of the beneficiaries of rent control might have to share apartments or even single rooms with other people in order to economize on rent. Others might have to move in with relatives. Still others might decide to move to remoter areas of the city where rents were cheaper, or to leave the city altogether. Please observe, none of the former beneficiaries of rent control would have to sleep in the street. They would simply have to occupy less space or live in less favorable locations. Now consider the fact that the apartments vacated by the former beneficiaries of rent control would not remain empty, but would practically all be occupied, because the rents on those apartments, though too costly for the rent control beneficiaries, would represent a decline in the rents charged in the open market. To use the same figures as in our auction example, assume that initially a beneficiary of rent control was paying a controlled rent of $50, while rents in the open market were $250. Now, with the repeal of rent control and the addition of the previously controlled apartments to the supply available in the market, rents in the market fall from $250 to $150. $150 is too expensive for the former rent control beneficiaries, but it represents a reduction in the rents charged in the open market and brings apartments within reach of people who could not afford them at the $250 a month rents caused by partial rent controls. In other words, what we are doing here is simply reversing the original auction example. Originally, I had two units. I gave one to the third weakest bidder at $50. That left one unit for the other two bidders to contend over. So the middle bidder was eliminated because he had to contend with the strongest bidder. Now I'm taking the unit back from the weakest bidder, putting two units on the market, the middle bidder will get a unit at a price or rent that he can afford. Let us focus on the new tenants who would occupy the previously controlled apartments. Let us try to figure out who they could be and where they are now. These are people who could afford their own apartments in the city at $150 a month, but not at $250 a month. At $250 a month, they find it necessary to share apartments or single rooms or to live with relatives or to live in remote areas of the city or out of town altogether. That is, they find it necessary to do all of the things that the beneficiaries of rent control might have to do if rent control were repealed. Perhaps some of you in the audience may know some of these victims of rent control, though you have probably not thought of them in that light before. They are young people who must live with roommates, young couples who must live with in-laws, families that cannot afford to live in the city, and so on. These people represent the class of rent control victims, though they are almost all unaware of that fact and see no connection between rent controls and their own plight. They are fully as numerous as the class of rent control beneficiaries, and they are already suffering as much hardship as the rent control beneficiaries would suffer if rent control were repealed. In fact, these victims of rent control are suffering vastly more hardship than the beneficiaries of rent control would suffer. Because if rent control were repealed, the total supply of housing would quickly begin to expand and its quality would improve. In places like New York City, the supply would increase almost overnight because the abandonment of buildings would cease and many previously abandoned buildings would be restored. The hardship of the former beneficiaries of rent control would be temporary because rental housing would once again become an expanding, progressing industry. As time went on, more and more of the former beneficiaries of rent control would be better off than they ever could have been under rent control. In the long run, everyone would be better off. The real answer to the question of what would happen to the present beneficiaries of rent control if rent control were repealed, therefore, is this. In the short run, and at the very worst, they would suffer less than the victims of rent control have already been suffering for many years. In the long run, what would happen to them is simply more and better housing. Furthermore, it should be stressed that in the long run, the very idea of someone being a beneficiary of rent control is a self-contradiction. The gains of the beneficiaries of rent control are made possible by the consumption of their landlord's capital. The tenant who is able to afford a better car, say, or an extra vacation because of the artificially low rent he pays, is buying that car or vacation at the expense of part of a new apartment building somewhere. And ultimately, he is buying it at the expense of the upkeep of the very building in which he lives. The day comes when he wants to move and finds no decent place to move to because he and millions of others like him have consumed the equivalent of all of the new apartment buildings that should have been built, for they have consumed their landlords' capitals and destroyed the incentives for building. Finally, the day comes when they have consumed the equivalent of a new boiler or wiring system or plumbing system that their own building needs, and their landlord has neither the means nor the incentive to try to replace it. Then they live in cold, in darkness, and without running water. This is already the fate of tens of thousands of people in Harlem and the South Bronx, as I have indicated. There is no reason why it could not happen to all controlled housing in the country, given further inflation and more time. The only gains from rent control are the gains of consuming the capital invested in housing and then being left without housing. People do it because the housing belongs to the landlords, not to them. But in the long run, the joke is on them because they are the physical beneficiaries of the stock of housing. When they destroy the property of the landlords, they destroy the property that serves them. My final application of the principle that partial controls raise prices on goods that are free of controls concerns oil prices. I will show how our existing controls on oil work to the benefit of the Arabs, and how their repeal would divert billions of dollars a year away from the Arab oil industry and to our oil industry at relatively little cost to American consumers. At the present time, domestically produced crude oil in the United States is controlled at an average price of $7.66 per barrel. Imported crude oil is uncontrolled. It is currently selling at about $13 a barrel, which is the price the Arabs receive. The prices of the various oil products produced in the United States, such as gasoline, heating oil, and so forth, are controlled on the basis of a weighted average of the price of imported oil and domestically produced oil. For example, since about 40% of our crude oil is imported and 60% is domestically produced, the present cost base can be taken as $13, the price of imported oil, times 40%, the proportion of oil that is imported, plus $7.66, the controlled domestic price, times 60%, its weight in the average. This is equal to an average of $9.80 per barrel. $9.80 can be taken as the present cost base on which the prices of oil products are set. So the government observes $9.80 is the average price of crude oil. It takes so much crude oil to produce a gallon of gasoline. The price of gasoline is controlled on the basis of a $9.80 per barrel cost of crude oil, and so on. Now, in order to understand how this arrangement benefits the Arabs and how its repeal would divert billions of dollars a year from their oil industry to our oil industry, all we have to do is think through the consequences of repealing our controls,